You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Sophia Shalmiev. Sophia, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Sophia, I know we're going to talk about your book, Mother Winter, but I'd like to ask what you're working on now. What's currently in your sphere of activity as a writer or otherwise?
I am working on two projects at once. I'm working on a poetry collection that's been sort of like my ongoing companion piece that I go back to even when I was working on Mother Winter. And I don't know when that will ever be finished. And it's called Father Fall Before Grace. And then I am just in the beginning stages of writing a novel. It's going to be called I Married the Butcher to Get to the Bone. And in it, my protagonist, Grace, is a single mother who, you know, thinks more than she does in life.
I love that title, I Married the Butcher to Get to the Bone. That's a wonderful title. Ask you a little bit about the poetry collection, which you said was a kind of companion to Mother Winter, it sounds like, Father Fall, and what was the
Father Falls Before Grace, yeah. And maybe that'll change when I'm done with it. But it's sort of like the glue in between this book, which is kind of like a lyric memoir, sort of like prose poem-y, kind of could have been an autofiction experimental novel, but sort of like the glue in between Mother Winter and I Married the Butcher, because in Mother Winter, we're just kind of sort of dealing with motherlessness and loss and coming into mothering and being an artist. And then the novel I'm working on is kind of exploring those themes and sort of like against the culture of mothering and against the culture of what I call nurture torture. And so I have a protagonist who fights with that, like fights with being in a dyad. So she leaves without having been beaten or cheated on, as every protagonist in every novel or short story I know of. She always has to be either left for a younger woman or she's leaving because there's a dramatic piece of abuse, but she just leaves to leave, and she's very ambivalent in her mothering. So it's sort of like that continuation, but it's mostly fiction. There's some things that I take from life or from my many, many, many girlfriends who thought marriage and motherhood would be one way, and it's never not, you know, what you think it is. And then the poetry collection that I've been working on for forever, sort of like something in between the cuts that didn't really make it into the book, and it is in an even choosing motherhood way. It looks a lot at the choice of abortion and the choices that men, fathers, ex-husbands, ex-boyfriends play in the woman's feelings about her body in general. So those are my two projects.
And tell me a little bit about the phrase nurture torture, which is a kind of interesting phrase that it seems that you coined or I haven't heard too much before. What do you mean by that when you use that?
Yeah, it's just something that I honed in on, and I mean, if I'm coining it, that's awesome because I haven't really heard it, but it's my idea, my feeling about the amount of the emotional labor and unseen invisible labor and planning labor and the expectations of bliss and happiness that have now come full circle, where we feel or we think that in culture we've achieved like a certain level of freedom and feminism for women. And yet, not just anecdotally, but from research, we see that women are just doing more and more double shifts and they have to do more and more work. And a lot of, you know, the men who are confused by our capitalist system not really holding them up is, you know, the model patriarchs anymore, not, you know, paying them as their fathers thought that they would be paid, you know, not being able to afford homes, all of the issues that people are facing right now, and men feeling lost just has not created a place where men pick up the nurturing slack. And so I call it nurture torture, where we haven't really gotten to the point where we have like any kind of a matriarchy where men do equal labor and women have positions of power and don't feel the constant guilt and are not hiding all the work that they do.
That's so interesting and true. And it's odd why we're not in a kind of matriarchy. You know, I just reading the book Sapiens, and there's a, you know, when he talks about just the evolution of Sapiens, he's at a loss to explain why, you know, societies and generally a matriarchy, that women seem to have all the attributes that would allow them to be ruling over men, and is kind of at a loss for why that is. That it's not about, makes an argument for that it's not about, you know, just pure strength. It's something that's and he's a pretty brilliant writer and seems to have a hard time nailing that down. But what I'd like to also talk about that you mentioned earlier, which this speaks to some of what you just mentioned, was the issue of abortion in that. I've always noticed that in television, even in Netflix and other dramas that are, you know, that are contemporary dramas, I can't ever remember and I researched this a little while ago, ever seeing a television show where there's an abortion. There's always one where that's being questioned, but the woman never has the abortion. And it seems to me like it's some kind of taboo still. I think when I was looking it up a while ago, there was one abortion in the 60s on television. And, I forgot what it was, not Mary Tyler Moore, but Maud or something. And the series was canceled immediately. So I don't know how that feeds into what you were saying about it, but it seems to be that's still something that, I mean, even more these days, is an enormously controlling aspect that perhaps men are still using over women, and even in a kind of corporate structure like media, like television and movies. Do you think that's the case? And I'm just trying to kind of get into what you were talking about there a little bit too, because that's an issue that I don't think is talked about it very much, except in these kind of polarizing views.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's a larger rhetorical question why we don't have a matriarchy, but I mean, even if we're looking at our current media coverage of the Democratic candidates, I do not understand. I mean, like, really, rhetorically, why don't all the men just kind of drop out and just support the women? Because if we had only had an Asian woman president in this country for the past 200 and some odd years, wouldn't sort of all the men kind of get and talk to the Asian women and say, hey, do you guys want to, like, support us for president for once? Just one of us,
right?
Just see how that goes. So I think it's up to the men. I think we don't have a matriarchy because for the men, a lot of these things are rhetorical rather than practiced. And I've noticed in all of my relationships with men who purport themselves to be feminists, and I appreciate that so much more than men who are openly misogynistic, is they're only feminists until it's inconvenient for them, or until that their ego is slighted, or until they're in direct competition with me. And then they're no longer so feminist. So that's one. And then in terms of abortion, I believe there was a movie, it was called Darling. Was it Julie Christie who was the lead in it? And that movie, I was actually one of the few and only movies, it was a 1965 movie, that had an abortion in it. There's a movie that recently came out called Obvious Child that had an abortion in it that was, like, not dramatic. And just very recently, based on the book Shrill by Lindy West, in the very first episode, a character who is a woman who openly says, I'm fat, like, deal with it, has an abortion because she has an accident. But I believe that it's a completely normal medical decision that any human being should make, except that human being happens to be having a womb, and we think that wombs are public until the women give birth to the children, and then we completely abandon them. And so in my book, I very freely, and thank goodness, you know, I have a fantastic editor, very freely speak of my mother, you know, almost having an abortion instead of having me, about the, just mentioning the fact that I even had one without really having to go into it, because that's not exactly what the book was about. But, you know, it's not just a taboo. It's a systemic way of taking control over, you know, it's like the means of production. Like, we want these women to continue to feel like crap about themselves. And what way to do that but to like shame them about any choice that they make, because they make the choice to become a mother. They don't have the resources. What the hell were you thinking becoming a mom if you can't afford that baby? Oh, you got pregnant. Well, you're a dumb slut. You should have kept your legs closed. But, you know, men ejaculate as many times as they want during the day, and so they can have 365 kids, or really, they can have a kid as many times as they ejaculate, and they are fertile 365 days a year. Women are fertile twice a month, so I can get pregnant very few times a year, and yet all the responsibility of that lies on me. And I don't know if it's an accident or a coincidence that men, it's in their best interest to make me think that it's all my fault. And you know, I've had abortions, Plan B failures, condom failures. I mean, it's not an exact science, all of these things. And yeah, our shame kind of keeps us from talking about it. It's very bizarre. And so I think in Mother Winter, I kind of thought about talking about the body in general. I start out right in the beginning, putting almost every fluid a body can produce out there.
So let's hear from that. I know you're going to read the beginning of Mother Winter. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would love to. All right, page one, Mother Winter. Russian sentences begin backward. When I learned English well enough to love it, I realized my inner tongue was running in the wrong direction, as does the Old Testament, the one we don't call the good book, the one that became the bad, forbidden book and is read back to front. The period blood came right after I began practicing my American accent in eighth grade, all smudged red clots to brown waste. I've been teaching my daughter to wipe herself front to back to avoid the chronic infections her body is prone to. She squats and glares at me, then follows her instinct for revolt no matter the aftermath. The daughters who live in flashbacks will suspend their tongues between the origin and the destination, the past more immediate, more urgent than any new day. Mother, loosen my tongue or adorn me with a lighter burden. Even Audre Lorde needs her mother's permission to grease the gears on the train to the beginning, to knock on coffins. I worship the flaneurs and flanuses, those who stroll about the city, especially the women who dare to walk alone at night and then write about it. But those who slink around with too little purpose or not enough clothing to cover their bodies are marked as streetwalkers or shluchas. This was one of your labels in my home. There may be no records beyond arrests or death certificates of a shlucha's gallivanting. I don't worship my real mother, but I can't get her buttermilk smell off my mouth. Almost all of the paper that contains your name was flushed down the toilet, lost, thrown away, or hidden like a lover who buries her face in the pillow when coming. All the letters I secretly wrote you were in English, and if I knew where to send them, you would have needed an auxiliary, a translator to convert my scribbles into her mother tongue. I didn't bother practicing my Russian on you. That river was dammed with teenage hormones and hopes of fitting in, a changeling in America. There was no address in Russia to mail anything to, and then I knew only your maiden name, Danilova, as well as the married and divorced from name we shared at one time, Shalmieva. I heard rumors that you had remarried and divorced twice since my father took you to court and the judge ruled you an unfit mother in the early 1980s. My uncle visited you in 1995 before he joined us on a visa in Brooklyn, but I only found out about these cordial gatherings a few years ago. At the time, you sat in your St. Petersburg apartment, looking frail and famished, close to our old place on Bronitska in what used to be Leningrad. I was a junior, deciding between Reed and Evergreen colleges, editing a high school feminist newspaper, listening to riot girl bands, writing poems for you, and auditioning surrogate mothers for myself. Feminists, writers, activists, painters, ballbusters, killjoys, sex workers, gay men. And so I assembled a fantasy caretaker army of mostly loose and tragic women mixed with audacious and assertive ones. a hologram of what I imagined you would be like if I hadn't been stolen from you. If you hadn't left me for the bottle long before my father took me away to America, 11 years your daughter. Elena, mother, mama, you. I choose you. And I'll end there.
Thank you, Sophia. So that was a great introduction. Also, our talk just before you read that kind of sets the stage. So this, of course, is, you know, about your mother that you're talking, and your arrival in America or leaving Russia. I know you're going to read another part from this, but to talk about what happened in between, of course, you came here and you're writing about your mother, but then you became a mother yourself. I don't know how old your daughter is.
My daughter is 6. My son is 10.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so I wanted to hear the passage where you talk a little bit about being an artist and a mother, or something related to that, because that does seem to be kind of curious to me, you know, how artists, parent, writers, parent, maybe it's my own kind of lens that I'm looking through on that, but I always end up sometimes after these interviews talking to mothers or fathers who are artists about parenting and and how it's a little bit different for artists. I mean, I don't know anything else, but my parents are musicians, artists, educators, and so I was raised by artists, but I also think that the way artists interact with kids is somehow a little bit different. I'm not being very articulate about that, but I mean that there's a different world that they're bringing to it. It's not just the world of academia, it's the world of perhaps expressions or art or things that are very alien to us, you know, artwork that we don't understand, words we don't understand, and being able to embrace those. And that seems to me a very kind of unusual way to bring up a kid.
And it's ongoing, right? It's not like, you know, because I used to, I'm also a visual artist, and I keep a studio, and I painted a painting show, a companion piece, a visual companion piece to Mother Winter. It's the Mother Winter painting show that I had up at Powell's a month after my book came out up in March. And so for me, these are all like really all-consuming things, right? It's like I could be away from my paintings, but I'm thinking about them. And if I didn't have my children right in front of me, I can like run up to my studio and get to painting. Or if I didn't have my children right in front of me, I would start writing down that paragraph that's sort of knocking at my head. And so that's really different than some other folks who don't have those lives. And I think the hard part about being a parent and an artist is that you are stuck in this really messed up sort of binary place where you're so consumed by yourself and your stuff and your thoughts that you're inherently kind of narcissistic and unavailable in some ways and selfish in some ways. And in other ways you are, like, because you're so much more porous, and there are so many more hinges, and there's so many things you open your children up to that you do expose your children to sort of different ways of looking at the world. But I think it's a very, very difficult place to be. And I'm happy to read something in the book about how I just sort of see even just the placement of a person who doesn't get to be like a successful artist, but maybe has the drive to do all the things that one would do if they didn't have children or didn't want to nurture. You know what I mean?
Right. And before you read that, I want to ask you a little bit more about your paintings, your work, and I didn't see the show. I've seen some of your work, and how that relates to your book, because oftentimes artists are seen with one medium or another. Knew a woman, Claude Wampler, who, you know, did performance art and also visual art, and they were, and even those worlds were very different. The performance crowd was somebody else. It was kind of a theater crowd. The visual art was another crowd. But they were very distinct crowds, and I would think with writing, that's the case too, that there's people who are, you know, fans of your writing and people who are fans of your painting, but In my experience, those crowds often don't aren't one and the same. The painting crowd doesn't necessarily read your book, and vice versa. Do you agree with that? Is that, I mean, how do you experience the reception of your paintings versus your book?
I don't have any commercial expectations. I don't have any media or any press or anything set up with my painting. It's sort of like, it's actually, even though I put stuff up on the wall, it's a completely private process. From like the beginning to the end, I paint, and then if I'm lucky enough to secure a show, maybe I'll have a quick little reception, and that's the least I hear about it, and that's pretty much it. It's sort of like, you know, in this vacuum that feels like it's almost just for me. And by the way, I'm happy. I'll send you images of that show. And then with the writing, it's a commerce. It's a machine. It's a cog. Like completely different from that end. Like, I love speaking to other artists about the craft, about, you know, everything having to do with the work, but the behind the scenes of it, the actually, you know, selling of the book versus, I mean, nope, I don't have any pressure to sell my paintings necessarily, and nobody really buys visual art enough. But with the book, when you have, you know, a publishing house that I'm lucky enough to have had, I mean, there's not a day that goes by that I can actually be like, oh, I don't have to cook that pot today. And so if I only wrote, that'd be great. But with writing, it's not like that at all. I wish it was more like with my painting, but I'm obviously very, very low rung on the, you know, on that kind of totem pole.
Well, there's not anything quite, even for artists, I mean, a gallery is the closest equivalent, but there's not anything quite like an agent and a publisher the way there is for writers,
yeah.
I think. I mean, but nevertheless, I mean, we're going to hear now how you're also writing about this, but there's, I always love reading writing. I was just recently reading Clarice Lispector and how she writes about also being a painter, and made me look up all her paintings. But we don't know much about, like you're talking about, a private practice. We don't know much about Clarice Lispector's paintings. You can look them up and find them, but there's very little on them. There isn't a monograph on them, but there's, of course, all these books of hers.
Right. Well, we have Leonora Carrington is one person that's like that. Yeah, we finally have her work and her paintings out. I don't know if you know her. Dorothy Press put out her stuff. She's now long gone. But yeah, it's an interesting hybridity. But I do think, again, like, we are looking at this from a solely, you know, capitalist commercial perspective. It's like, you know, are you a poet? Are you a novelist? Are you a memoirist? Like, where do I put you in the bookstore? How do I catalog you? Are you putting, you know, your energy into too many things? Are you, like, really, you know, are you a dilettante or are you serious? Like, what is this about? So it's just very interesting. Like, we don't think about it, but unless you're very established, you kind of have to, like, pick lanes and, like you said, like, have crowds and have support and have community. And not everybody's like that, or not everybody even has the means or the access or the way to be like that, which is insane to me, because it should just be about the work. But how do people find out about the work? You have to promote it.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, recently I have interviewed more than one visual artist that simply doesn't show, that they've chosen to make their work, and it's not about showing. They're not against the art market, but they're not interested in engaging in the art market, and they seem happy for it. They're content that way. So, but it is an interesting kind of situation that's often difficult to navigate. And I think you're right. There is this kind of market driven thing, or capitalist driven notion of how do I define you? What market are you? Like you're saying, where in the bookstore, or where in the, you know, how are you going after your quote unquote market, so to speak? Which is, you know, historically not how artists work, right?
Yeah, and it depends on who's funding the artist. Sometimes, like, if somebody can afford to keep their art private or for themselves, because maybe they have, like, a rich girlfriend who supports them. I'm a single mother. For me, if this book doesn't do well, that's fine. But at the same time, like, nobody's going to, like, want an agent or, like, really go after my poetry collection, because poetry doesn't sell it. If I'm lucky enough to have, you know, my agent shop it around somewhere, that's great. But, you know, for my novel, if everybody knows this, but nobody really talks about it because it's supposed to be so perverted to discuss like the money aspect of things. But if your first book doesn't sell, or if you camped out and didn't do anything to promote it, and if you weren't one of the few lucky people who just, you know, got like swept into the current of adoration, then your second book is just not going to really sell or get a measly advance, or you know, it's difficult. It's like it is an actual business, and that does suck, but not talking about it, as I think we think that it's like uncouth to do, is a very strange, it's a very privileged way to be. I grew up in a socialist communist country. I am, you know, very lower middle class to sometimes just broke and poor. So like I have very blue collar sensibilities when it comes to talking about money and how things function. And I think that's really the only people that it's good for in terms of hiding this stuff is for people who have money. Do you know what I mean? So it's important to discuss the means of production. It only serves, you know, the giant, you know, fat cats for us not to discuss it. But in that sense, I have to say that I don't have the option. Like, I don't have the option to just say that my stuff is private. I'm not in that space. I would just be private and destitute.
right. Yeah, that really rings true in a number of ways, because I talk to other artists about these issues, and I'm always asking people, you know, are you teaching, or what else is happening? Because I'm also curious how people are surviving. And so I should ask you, are you teaching and doing other work as well?
Yeah, I do several things. I teach like at places like Hugo House, for example, in Seattle, and just pick up jobs that way. And I also freelance, edit, and write reviews, and just really scrape by with that kind of work. Yep.
You know, it's interesting what you said before, that it is almost to ask that question or to talk about money in you know, in the art world seems almost kind of perverse. When I was talking to a one artist who represented his country in the Venice Biennial and does this kind of very performance-oriented and conceptual work, often work that's not sellable, and I asked him about that and his gallery and sales, and he says, well, you know, when I'm showing some work and I see the guy next to me sell a painting for $100,000, I have to tell you, you know, it pisses me off. He says, I'm working really hard to try to raise money for something that doesn't make money.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he said, I know we're not supposed to talk about money. It's not about money. He said, but at the same time, you know, I could use more. And I see someone making a painting that looks okay to me. I don't think he put in the same kind of energy I'm putting into this, you know, incredibly elaborate performance in a Walmart or something. But he said, you know, it's frustrating and difficult, and I can't seem to talk about it. And
yeah,
it was funny,
taboo.
After that interview, his gallerist wrote to me, and he said, wow, that was really hard to hear. You know, I was kind of wincing at that. But he said, at the same time, it's nice to hear artists be so honest, you know, because that is what's happening.
Oh, he's even lucky to be in the game. That's how I feel about it. I feel really, like, actually incredibly, completely lucky that I, you know, got the agent that I got, who's fantastic and, like, really believed in me and understands, you know, things about art. And then I got an editor who, you know, himself is, you know, an artist and just rigorous and so smart. And so in terms of getting to make the thing that I wanted to make, I have not one thing to complain about. So that's just, like, my takeaway in the end.
So let's hear from this last reading from your book. I don't know if you want to preface it at all, but
yeah.
I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, this is, I'm just going to read a little snippet of page 239, where I sort of talk about my position now that I'm a mother, and I'm sort of in a lull space with my artwork because I just had a second kid and I'm in the middle of trying to make stuff and it's not coming. Page 239. It's by the sink and then by the record stack that I think of Kat Marnell. You don't know. You've heard of Kat Marnell? Sure, okay, but you do not understand how much she makes me think of my mother, how much I wish to protect her. The men stealing her fire and torching her like she's boneless and will vanish quickly enough, all while she hangs on to their dear legs for life. Our connective tissue is stiff after a lifetime of men colliding into us, into our desecrated foremothers, the Connie Ramones, the girlfriends, the groupies, the support staff with a mattress, diving off bar stools while the men we reared dove off stages. I put on an anthem to make the chores seem like theater, turn off the radio show that goes on about our narrow approaches to sexuality, aggressively advertised or chronically repressed. They should try being the three of us. Choice, like at a prison canteen. Choice from that deep a lack needs to be modeled and learned anew. I get the dishes done, lurch forward. I hate the wiping part. All the kitchen towels smell like last week, no matter how much you wash and repeat. I fuck the forks up. I notice myself not doing it right, fighting with the egg yolk, but I'd rather wipe the crud off on my skirt when the table gets set later. I hate sitting down at a table to eat. I think about Kat Marnell when I do the dishes because I know she eats in bed, she eats off of other people's plates, or she doesn't eat. If you don't use your body beyond the bare branch, the bloom is beside the point. It is for suckers to grow flowers, pansies like me, crossed off, cross-shaped like a lilac, doing dishes here while Kat Marnell parties. My kind of girl. It's insulting to consider my potential for danger here at the sink while Susan Griffin makes duplicates of echoes. This is a poem for a woman doing dishes. This is a poem for a woman doing dishes. It must be repeated. It must be repeated again and again and again. When I finally saw Jean Dielman, the Chantal Ackerman film of my mother's nightmares, a quickening like that of a first kick from the baby in the womb, tapped away at my forehead. Ackerman used an actress of glamour and stature to do mundane chores for nearly 200 minutes, famously peeling potatoes long enough to put you into nausea. But you got sick because a contrast had been staged. The beautiful woman who prostituted and made veal cutlets in her home with the same dry yet faithful regard for ritual was still human to the viewer, maybe finally so, unlike most wives and mothers whose identity Elena vomited up at her own peril. And I'll end there.
Thank you, Sophia. Great passage. I'm glad you selected that one. There's you know, that relates also to the kind of labor issue you were talking about earlier, but just a great piece of writing too. Very, very powerful. Thank you. Are you continuing to do readings? Is that part of this book process?
Yeah, I'm still kind of on book tour to this at this point. Tonight I have a reading with Lainey Zumas at Broadway Books here in Portland, and then I move on and go to Ohio. I'll be reading in Cleveland on Tuesday. I believe that's the 23rd of this month, April, and then I'm going to Nashville and reading there at Third Man Books on the 28th. So, and then finally, I think I get to come home and kind of write for a little bit while longer.
That sounds nice. Well, there'll be links to, of course, all of that in this interview. And I want to ask you one more question. What are you reading now? I'm always interested.
Yeah, I have been reading this Galley by a writer called Jeannie Venasco. She wrote the book Glass Eye, and this new book that's going to be coming out soon is called Things We Didn't Talk About When I Was a Girl. Both books came out with Tin House, and it's a really interesting, great book about her getting to interview actually the man when they were teenagers. He's a man now who had committed sexual assault against her, and so she actually gets to speak with him, and rather than sort of, you know, isolate or punish him or try to deal with it on her own, how does he take responsibility and how did he see what had happened, which is really great. And then I'm reading the complete stories of Leonora Carrington, whom I mentioned, who is a visual artist and a writer, and a really interesting book I'm rereading right now. It's called I'll Drown My Book. It's sort of like a little anthology composed of conceptual women's writing. It's very interesting.
Sophia, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time.
Oh my God, thank
you
for your questions. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.